FirstAmendmentRadio.net, around the world and on satellite.
Roll away the dawn, roll away the dawn, and let me see the land of the free. Has anything changed now? Sweet liberty, sweet liberty is in our hands. It's part of the plan, or is it a state of mind? Never forget!
You're listening to Jackie Patru and Sweet Liberty. And now, here's your host, Jackie Patru.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us tonight on Sweet Liberty. It is Wednesday. It is the 15th of March in the year 2006, the Ides of March. And last night, Alan isn't with us tonight. He'll be back with us next week. And I mentioned to you last night that we will be doing Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday because Darren has to work. And last night, I began reading to you from an article called The Pandemic That Will Never Be. And this is the one I chose because it just pretty much covers the gamut. I want to finish it tonight. Darren worked in the night last night, and he has got a new section, ready to go on the bird flu so that we can put this information. And what I'm going to do is, I mentioned last night that the one article that really got me doing the research on this, not that it was news to me, but I thought it was time that we cover this and cover it thoroughly and leave as no stones unturned if possible. And excuse me, the name of the article, well, I don't even remember, but anyway, it was saying that it is coming. It will be here this spring. The UN official was saying that, and former Governor Leavitt from Utah, who's now Health and Human Services Secretary, he said if it isn't this one, there will be a pandemic. And so I had called Alan to get his comments on that before I posted it. So what I've decided to do, because I really get struck gold, he told us about a documentary that the CBC did, and I went back there and found it, and there were 14 clips dating back from 1957, folks, and you ought to see the inconsistencies. They basically pretty much admit that the Asian flu was a scam, and what the heck was the other one, the Hong Kong or whatever, swine flu. It was the same thing that was going on then that's going on now. And the U.S. government actually got sued, I guess. I'm not sure which of the flus it was. But anyway, what I'm going to do is I'm going to use Alan's comments as an introductory to that section. And as soon as I get, and I'm putting all of those links in it, so our visitors to that section can just hit a link and they can go back in time right from the CBC archives and see the way this thing has been reported. But so that's where we are on this. And I'm going to pick up in the article. It's called The Pandemic That Will Never Be. And we were on the subject of Tamiflu. Tamiflu is not an injection. They're pills. And it says here that the author, I think his name is Tim Shea, says that Tamiflu is approved by the FDA on November 20th, 2000, and the manufacturer made extravagant claims about its effectiveness from the outset. And this is a quote here. It says, the results of several clinical studies show that Tamiflu is up to 92% effective in preventing influenza illness in adolescents, adults, and the elderly when taken once daily. The author says that Gilead, he was a representative of the pharmaceutical company Gilead, G-I-L-E-A-D, also claims that Tamiflu, quote, is the first antiviral pill effective against all common strains of flu that can safely protect people who are in close contact with someone who has it. And the author says, not surprisingly, no actual studies are cited by the manufacturer when making these claims. As is the case with all pharmaceutical companies, chemical companies, and government regulating agencies, Gilead has two departments, the science department and the public relations department. The two departments operate separately from each other with no crossover fact-checking system in place for consistency. Much of what appears on their website about Tamiflu, as well as what they claim it can do, is the work of Gilead's PR department. To find out what the actual scientists say about Gilead's Tamiflu, we have to look at the physician's desk reference, the technical Bible of the drug industry. It can be found in the reference section of any library and is the bane of most medical practitioners as well as journalists. They never cite it, mainly because they never read it. From that source, we find a little different story. We find that the supposed action of Tamiflu is that it is assumed to prevent flu viruses from collecting on cells by specifically inhibiting a certain enzyme that helps viruses to bind to cells. The enzyme is called a neuraminidase. I probably am myrtleizing that word. The first problem is that they don't know for sure if that is the action of the drug, and also refer to it as the, quote, proposed mechanism of activity. But more pertinently, the scientists state that even though this seems to be how the drug works in culture, quote, the relationship between the activity in a culture and the inhibition of influenza virus replications in humans has not been established. So in other words, the scientists who formulated this drug are stating they don't even know whether or not it works in humans. As this is the drug that all of American media is hawking to the skies as the savior that must be stockpiled against the coming plague of avian flu, the only hope of, for the survival of our species. Even if Tamiflu could inhibit, listen to this now, this is what Alan tried to get across to us, even if Tamiflu could inhibit virus proliferation in humans, it wouldn't work for very long in our entire population. Why not? Mutation influenza viruses are one of the fastest mutating. Oh, he says mutation. Influenza viruses are one of the fastest mutating of all known human viruses, mutating several times in one flu season, not just in a given location, but even within the same person. At any one time across the country, there are literally hundreds of strains of influenza in people. And this is precisely why flu shots have never worked and have had virtually no effect on the incidence of flu in this country for the past several years. With Tamiflu, again, the scientists readily admit that, quote, insufficient tolerance or the ability of viruses to mutate so as to be unaffected by the drug. Resistance means tolerance, or the ability of viruses to mutate so as to be unaffected by the drug. We see the same exact phenomenon every year with the creation of many new infections of which people die because the organisms become completely resistant to all known antibiotics. This is the result predicted by Alexander Fleming, and he's the one, he said, that discovered penicillin. That he was right on the money, not even controversial, and that's what the guy had said, is that his concern was that there would be over-medication and people would build up resistance. And that, you know, it's a good thing for us to remember this, folks, not to take antibiotics every time something happens, because once we do that, we're building up resistances in our bodies to those antibiotics. And as I mentioned last night, garlic is a natural antibiotic and the body does not build up a resistance to it. Tamiflu is no good after 2 days. Listen to this. Another limitation of Tamiflu is the short window of opportunity for its claimed effectiveness. Again, from the 2005 physician desk reference, listen to this. Tamiflu is indicated for the treatment of uncomplicated influenza infection in patients 1 year and older who have been symptomatic for no more than 2 days. For no more than 2 days. In other words, the manufacturers are saying Tamiflu doesn't work if the patient has had the flu for more than 2 days. Never saw that in the Newsweek, did you? Reading on, the manufacturer is not clear that Tamiflu can help any patients who were already sick when they got the flu. They further state that they don't know if multiple courses of Tamiflu are safe because they never tested for more than one course. The manufacturers then state they cannot guarantee safety for the fetus if a pregnant woman takes Tamiflu. Therefore, they don't recommend Tamiflu for pregnancy. Did you see that one in the paper? Side effects of Tamiflu, here's what the PDR lists. Rash, swelling of face, epidural necrolysis. I don't know what that is. I'm sure Alan would know. Hepatitis. One of the side effects, cardiac arrhythmia, aggravation of diabetes, and, seizures. Seems pretty risky for a drug that has never been proven to work in humans. Think I'll stick with my odds of being part of the 6.5 billion instead of the 60. He's referring to the 60 that they claim have died. It's a pandemic, folks. 60 people allegedly have died from this avian flu. And that, like he said, and I read it to you last night, that's alleged because they're assuming. And maybe nobody has died from it. Remember how we read last night? They admitted themselves from World Health Organization that it's very rare for an avian flu to skip species, to cross species. It is very species specific. And then the author goes on. He says, remember now, Tamiflu has been around since 2000. The above facts from the most current science known about Tamiflu shows the progress that has been made with this drug after 6 years. Precious none. Precious little, he says. Tamiflu had no effect on ordinary flu incidents during the past 6 years. Why is it now suddenly being glorified as the magic bullet for the, quote, new pandemic? Let's guess. Because there's nothing else, and something's better than nothing, even if it's almost completely hopeless. When the topic of epidemic pops up, the big money is really on vaccines. Vaccines are given yearly, and they're for everyone in the world. The Bush administration has funded a Swiss drug company, Sanofi, S-A-N-O-F-I, Pasteur, $100 million to develop a vaccine for avian flu. And by the way, I want to remind you, he's got, I don't know how many resources here, but there's little numbers here where when he makes a statement, you can go down and check the resource from it. Specifically, it was the National Institute of Health who did the awarding of this money, and today it was way back. This printing is kind of cut off the tops of my letters, and some of these words are hard to read. Specifically, it was the NIH who did the awarding, and oddly, it was way back in May of 2004. Conveniently, Sanin also has a plant in Pennsylvania. That's Sanofi, I think. I'm sorry, S-A-N-O-F-I. On 1st of November 2005, Bush made it clear that there was plenty more where that $100 million came from when he announced that $7.1 billion was being allocated to combat avian flu with drugs and vaccine. $7.1 billion, folks. And remember, Rumsfeld is figuring big in that. He's coming out like a bandit, making out like a bandit with this. Director of Health and Human Services Mike Leavitt parroted his predecessor Tommy Thompson almost verbatim when he said, quote, "We need to have the capacity to produce 300 million courses of a vaccine for any strain of a pandemic flu. For any strain. We need to have the capacity to produce 300 million courses of a vaccine for any strain of a pandemic flu." I remember that article, that short article I read to you last night. They said that if the flu hits, if, in fact, this avian flu does skip species, it'll be 6 months before that there's a vaccine for it. Do you see all the inconsistencies, folks? That's why I think it's really going to be good. Excuse me. It's the aftermath of that flu I had. I think it's going to be great to have this information all in one place at our website at sweetliberty.org, and hopefully people will see the contradictions. He said those were Tommy Thompson's same words exactly 3 years before, but he was talking about smallpox vaccine for the pandemic du jour. And after 2 years of hysteria and $3 billion, we all know what happened to that program. It was scrapped before the vaccine manufacturers even met their production quotas. And now you don't hear about it anymore. With SARS, it was slightly more money, $40 billion, with 800 deaths worldwide. Those are alleged deaths, of course. Only catch is that almost all the deaths were diagnosed by symptoms only, no lab tests. And I read an article way back then when that SARS scam was coming out, and this was something that I don't know that made it to the mainstream, but I think it was some foreign newspaper report, that they found out that were killing the people in China that was supposed to be this SARS, was or whatever country it was, is terrible sanitary conditions in the area where it broke out. So there was no such thing as SARS either, I would bet saying. The author says this astounding statement about the new vaccine was actually made by the World Health Organization. Listen to this. Quote, "Although a vaccine against the H5N1 virus is under development in several countries, no vaccine is ready for commercial production, and no vaccines are expected to be widely available until several months after the start of a pandemic." Now read it again. This appeared on the World Health Organization site the same month that Sanofi Pasteur was awarded the $100 million and is still part of their frequently asked question sheet. Since they keep predicting over and over that a pandemic could occur at any time, even now, then why would WHO, World Health Organization, here be expecting the pandemic to be courteous enough to hold off until the vaccines are created and stockpiled? The notion is absurd, but it indicates the exact way that a disease epidemic must always be marketed. The disease is tied to the vaccine. When the vaccines are ready, magically, the disease threat disappears. Like with SARS and with smallpox vaccine, such an idea is totally unscientific, even if their own paradigm of the germ theory of disease were actually valid. And this heading is avian flu vaccine, no vaccine can mutate. Clinical trials developing a vaccine for avian flu are just beginning. Trials are small and few. This is a quote from one of his sources, and we're at 31 references now. it doesn't take much imagination to see the smoke and mirrors behind the, quote, development game. With billions available, practically any study gets funding. No one is talking about the virtual impossibility of ever creating an effective vaccine again because of mutation. As with most vaccines, the same old unscientific methods are being employed in developing the new avian flu vaccine. Here's a quote. It says the vaccine being studied is made of pieces, listen to this, is made of pieces of the outside of the virus, which is weakened before being grown in chicken eggs and then killed before it's made into the vaccine. That's end quote, and there's a reference there. As usual, the fundamental axioms of immunology are ignored. These scientists are creating something totally different from a naturally existing pathogen. When injected into a human, any immune response will be related to that man-made strain, not to any naturally occurring strain. So even if the vaccine were able to trigger an immune response, it would be the wrong one. Did you follow that, folks? In other words, the methods that they're using in developing the vaccine, I'm going to do that again. This is the quote, that the vaccine being studied is made of pieces of the outside of the virus, which is weakened before grown in chicken eggs and then killed before it is made into the vaccine. And as the author points out, these scientists are creating something totally different from a naturally existing pathogen. When injected into a human, any immune response will be related to that man-made strain, not to any naturally occurring strain. So even if the vaccine were able to trigger an immune response, it would be the wrong one. Man, this is unbelievable. That's just for starters. As above, we saw how influenza viruses are the most rapidly mutating microbes of all. It'll be years before enough avian flu vaccine is produced to cover an order for 300 million doses. But that's okay, because long before that, the threat itself will magically evaporate, just like SARS and smallpox. But certainly not before all the billions in funding have been spent. So we must be prepared for a few years at least of continued programmed hysteria to keep the market value high. Indemnifying Big Pharma. In another striking reprise, November 2002, when two secret riders were tacked onto the Homeland Security Act at the last minute and passed into law, Bush has asked for the same provision in the 2005 avian flu funding. Drug manufacturers are to be held harmless from dangerous damages resulting from new drugs and vaccines for avian flu. Historically, Bush can always be counted on to defend the pharmaceutical industry. Well, it isn't just Bush, is it, folks? It's any president that's ever been in office has only taken its orders from those who, quote, advise him, control him, put him into office. How many cases of avian flu are we really talking about? According to National Institutes of Health, in March 2005, there were 69, quote, confirmed cases between January 2004 and March 2005, resulting in 46 deaths. NIH doesn't state how the cases were confirmed, but cites World Health Organization as their source for the figures. This figure, which most sources cite as the total human cases worldwide, doesn't really seem that bad considering that it was 1997 when the first cases in humans were reported. It's a real pandemic, isn't it, folks? A real pandemic. on 10th of October 2005, WHO reported, WHO, I'll say that because that can be confusing. On 10 October 2005, WHO reported that there were five, quote, laboratory-confirmed cases of H5N1 infection in Indonesia so far. Again, this doesn't seem bad, realizing that the area of the world where most cases are being reported, Vietnam, Thailand, Cambodia, Hong Kong, Indonesia, etc., hold 1.8 billion people. Five laboratory-confirmed cases out of 1.8 billion people. Much of this area is characterized by the world's worst poverty and starvation, which are the real causes of disease. Consider these figures and see if they add up to pandemic. The first cases of avian flu were reported in Hong Kong in 97, supposedly with 8 deaths. Then it faded away and didn't appear again in Hong Kong till February of 2003, 5 years later, when there were how many new cases in the outbreak? In the outbreak, one. That's one single case. Some pandemic. The disease goes away completely for 6 years, and when one new case finally pops up, they start talking pandemic. That's marketing in the U.S. today. One child in 150 is now becoming autistic, and yet the word epidemic is never used in mainstream press or in medical literature to describe this true skyrocketing epidemic, which now affects over 900,000 American children. Speaking of that, well, let me go on here. Well, I want to say this because it came into my mind. I have a, according to reports that I read, autism had actually increased by 1,600%, folks, and it was a very fast, quick, very rapid increase in it. And, of course, they have connected it to the thimerosal, mercury that's in the vaccines, along with aluminum and God knows what else. And they're, from what I understand, they're now leaving the thimerosal out of the vaccines. I read a report recently that the cases of autism are, the numbers of cases are dropping. So maybe something is. But, of course, for all those hundreds of thousands of babies that have been made brain dead and autistic, there's no taking that back, is there? Proponents of the avian, quote, pandemic now supposedly threaten the world. Now supposedly threatening the world. Okay, let me start that over. Proponents of the avian pandemic, now supposedly threatening the world, are relying that most people have a very short memory, and they design media ops geared to create maximum fear and panic. The rhetoric used at present to describe what could happen with Asian flu projects a variety of fantastic estimates of possible deaths. The number of people, this is a quote, the number of people it could kill range from 2 million to 50 million people. And then another quote says, it could be the trigger for a global pandemic that could kill 150 million people. As long as we're yielding to wild conjecture here, pulling stats out of the air, why not 2 billion people? That's a nice round figure. We're probably going to take a break here, folks. I have trouble hearing the little signal, and it's my fault because I should call Nicholas and ask him if he could up the volume on that a little bit. Because if I'm talking, I very often miss the warning. So I don't want to be in the middle of, I believe last night I talked right through to the end because I didn't hear the warning. Well, maybe grandfather's running up faster.
If you'd like to get a copy of this program, there are a few ways that we can help you. You may subscribe at FirstAmendmentRadio.com for only $45 a month, and you'll receive an MP3 CD weekly of all of our programs. As a bonus, we'll send you a password for our audio archives online. That's a $15 value. Or you may request any month of any program on one MP3 CD for a minimum donation of only $25, or any single program on tape, MP3 CD, or CD for only $15. You may do all of this online at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Just follow the instructions to make a donation or subscribe. You may also adopt an hour of your favorite program. Please don't forget that most of the programs on FirstAmendmentRadio.com are listener-supported. Don't do Internet? Then call 559-781-3773 and we'll be honored to help you. Thank you from all of us here at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Now listen to me. The Bible says, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. I want you to know that a corporation is Caesar.
Government takeover of the church. This DVD is the most powerful tool we have for waking up those asleep in the pews. The scripture calls for his people to come out of her. The corporate church is the apostate church, the whore that rides the beast. Get this DVD for a donation of $25 from FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Make copies and give them away to your corporate church friends and loved ones. The truth will make them free. They will watch the DVD, Government Takeover of the Church. Order online today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com or call 559-781-3773. Who will tell them if not you?
Since the beginning of time, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, it has been borrowed, it has been purchased, it has been stolen. There's a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and to our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188 or visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, and regular guest, world-renowned economist Robert Chapman, right here on FirstAmendmentRadio.com at 4 p.m. Eastern or 1 p.m. Pacific Time. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, 1-800-375-4188. Years ahead of the dominant media, FirstAmendmentRadio.com and FirstAmendmentRadio.net, around the world and on satellite.
Okay, we're back, folks. I think I see that I'm going to be able to finish this before this evening's over, at least by the time we're done here. So I hope that you're able to catch and really register what I've been sharing with you here. This article will be sent over to Darren so that he can post it in the bird flu section. And then maybe what you can do at sweetliberty.com, of course, what you can do is, if you're having trouble getting your friends and your loved ones, your associates, really grasping the scam of this whole thing, then maybe you can either direct them to that section, or you can print out and hand them some of the information. I chose this one because, as I said earlier, it just really covers the whole gamut here. So now we're at the section titled Bird Deaths. He says, few areas of reporting exhibit the level of irresponsibility as those describing how many birds have actually died so far. Here's a quote. Despite the death or destruction of an estimated 150 million birds, the virus is now considered endemic in many parts of Indonesia and Vietnam, and in some parts of Cambodia. You know what? What this reminds me of? In his commentary on this, Alan mentioned a statement that Henry Kissinger had made, that overpopulation is in the world is the greatest national security threat to the U.S. I did a search on it. I found it, and it will be posted. And there was a whole doggone report written, and the one that I have linked in Alan's commentaries, because he did mention it, is it was a report that Kissinger did on genocide by starvation. Okay, now I was just thinking about this. 150 million birds have been destroyed. 150 million. And yet the virus is now considered endemic in many parts of Indonesia, Vietnam, and some parts of Cambodia. Boy, that's a good way to depopulate by starvation, isn't it, folks? Another quote says, in East Africa, it was responsible for the deaths of 140 million birds, including those intentionally destroyed. Yeah, there were probably 139,900,000 destroyed. Remember what they did over there in Europe with the mad cow disease? Piles and piles and piles, thousands, tens of thousands of cows. Oh, I think it was hoof and mouth. Hoof and mouth. And they admitted after they did this that they didn't have to do it. Hoof and mouth, most of the cattle survive it, and once they have survived it, they're immune to it. And some of the people that were going around killing them admitted that a majority of the cattle that they killed had already recovered from hoof and mouth disease, folks. Depopulation by starvation. The author says different sources, different stats. When there's no way to check and no real accountability, doesn't really matter what one says, does it? The science behind the avian flu. There are three issues of science which one must look at in any new disease being evaluated. They are testing, isolation, and titer, T-I-T-E-R. He says if you're proposing that there is a new disease and it is being caused by a certain microbe, in order to prove your case, you must photograph and sequence the pathogen, cause the disease by implanting the isolated pure microbe in a healthy subject. Determine titer, which is the number of the particular bacteria or virus necessary to cause the disease in a subject every time. That's what titer means. Titer is the number of the particular bacteria or virus necessary within the body to cause the disease in a subject every single time. These are the classic principles of pathology accepted by most scientists. Let's look at each one of them briefly, see if they're being followed in the recent studies and experiments surrounding avian flu. Toxins, poisons, and certain amounts of pathogens can trigger the inflammatory response in the human body. The immune system triggers the formation and release of specific proteins called immunoglobulins, and antibodies. Examples include IgE, IgA, IgM, etc., etc. Once formed, many immunoglobulins will persist in the body for a long time. That way, if the trigger ever shows up again, specialized lymphocytes called memory cells will be able to recognize it immediately and mobilize the body's survival mechanisms to fight it. So, as we wade through the recent findings and stories appearing in media about the discovery of avian flu in various locations, what is of critical importance will be exactly how the field researchers are coming to their conclusions about what they have found. Critical questions about the birds. When they say they've found 50 birds in a field that supposedly have the H5N1 strain of the H5 avian flu virus, if the story is to have any credibility, we must know how they tested the birds. We must know also the answers to these questions. Were the birds tested alive or dead? Were the birds tested for the presence of an antibody to H5N1 or to H5? Were the birds tested for the presence of H5N1 itself? Were the birds tested for the presence of H5? If tested for the virus itself, what was the count? How much was there? Could the finding be isolated, photographed, and identified with certainty? And the last question, were the birds tested at all? Since most reports and articles do not describe how the researchers tested the birds, it's impossible to know what they mean when they say that any given bird died from avian flu. John Rappaport, a researcher who's been following the story since the beginning, believes that most of the field testing on birds is just an antibody test, which may simply mean that all the researcher did was find a single immunoglobulin to H5N1 in the bird. Now, if the bird is dead, the presence of antibodies only means that the bird was exposed to the virus at one time and it triggered antibody production, which probably just means that the immune system was working properly and the bird survived. The presence of antibody in a dead bird cannot be assumed to be the cause of death. And since these antibody tests are much easier to do than isolating a live virus, it's likely that most of the field testing is done this way. Including birds that were diagnosed in this way would certainly be misleading in assessing the extent of the disease. It is very likely that a large percentage of the numbers we're seeing in media is being assembled in exactly this manner. It's also likely that most testing is done on dead birds, since they're much easier to catch. But don't be misled. Most of the 150 million birds worldwide who've supposedly died from avian flu have not been tested. The manpower simply does not exist for that much work. And since avian flu is one of the biggest media events in the past 5 years, the tendency would be to count any bird that dies of anything as being dead from avian flu. Otherwise, it's just another boring bird dying an ordinary boring death. This may sound simplistic, perhaps, but Rappaport is one of the few researchers who has brought up this very logical and valid objection to the mass marketing that is underway. Did you understand what he was saying there? It made me think of the TB time tests they give. If a person has had TB, they will always test positive for it, even once. Sometimes the body cures it itself, and sometimes they take medication to cure it. But the point is, there are antibodies there against it. So if they test for TB, it's always going to come up with a positive test. That's what he was saying in the testing of these birds, that just because they found an antibody doesn't mean they died of it. It could have been a bird that had had an avian flu and didn't die of it, and so therefore there was the presence of an antibody. And the author goes on. He says it's also likely that most testing is done on dead birds. Oh, I already did that. Just a minute, excuse me. Jump down here. He says, now since the type of testing is rarely, if ever, identified in most reports, let's give the field researchers credit for a large proportion of cases where they actually isolated the virus from the subject, just to be fair. And let's say they come up with the correctly sequenced isolated H5N1 virus. And let's say they come up with a correctly sequenced isolated H5N1 virus in the dead bird's blood. Is this a case of avian flu? Nobody knows. Even though they're saying yes every time, they don't really know, and it's junk science to say that they do know. Titer, the unknown value. Why? It's about titer. Titer is the number of the pathogen that has been clinically determined as the requisite amount that must be present in the subject to cause the disease. The H5N1 titer has never been established for avian flu, which actually means that scientists don't know what causes avian flu, Could be a virus, could be bacteria, could be environmental. H5N1 is just a theory. It's not a scientific fact. Nobody knows. Until those facts are known, there's no such thing as avian flu, except the illusion created by the media. So, now media and marketing psychology are in the mix. Bush just committed $7 billion, $7 billion to fighting avian flu, the majority of which is for Tamiflu and vaccine development. God, are these people getting filthy rich, aren't they, folks? Are global multinationals like Hoffman, LaRoche, and Gilead Sciences going to be gearing up a $7 billion program to produce antivirals and vaccines for a disease that isn't caused by a specific microbe? Time to review recent history again. SARS and smallpox vaccine. With SARS, no microbial agent was ever identified and proven as the cause. And no SARS as the disease, and so SARS as the disease was never proven to exist. And yet, we spent $40 billion in the past 4 years chasing that phantasm. With smallpox vaccine, the deception was accomplished much more easily. They had 200 years of worldwide vaccination indoctrination that used the wrong pathogen all the time. But even so, it was still a single pathogen and therefore easy to sell the idea of the vaccine. And the smallpox, I don't know if you've read reports on it. Girls, quit it. I'm sorry. My girls here are wrestling. They get to growling. In the smallpox vaccine, it wasn't smallpox that the vaccine was made out of. It was cowpox, folks, and it was two separate types of pathogens. So in other words, the smallpox vaccine was not a vaccine against smallpox. It was a vaccine against cowpox, which I don't think people get. And that's the same thing this author is saying about the SARS. And he says avian flu is no different. We need a single pathogen. It doesn't have to be the correct one. One just has to be assigned, and then everyone will stick with the story, and the science will go on its merry way until the funding runs out, and that'll be years. We need an Osama bin Laden for our avian flu, a single causative agent. H5N1, why not? It's as good as anything else. We're right on track with that one. Causes of death, once the diagnosis of avian flu has been made, are presumed to be just that. No matter what the patient dies of, in 12, quote, confirmed cases in Bangkok, 8 were treated with powerful corticosteroids. When 6 of those 8 died, their deaths were attributed to the virus, not the drugs. So 8 people were treated out of 12. 6 of the 8 died. 6 of the 8 that were treated. And their deaths were attributed to the virus, not the drugs. He says weak, poor people with fragile immune systems often do not have the strength to withstand powerful drugs like prednisone. But then we're not marketing a cure for prednisone. We're marketing a cure for avian flu. The germ theory and food poisoning. He said it may be difficult at first to get your brain around the idea that germs don't cause disease, since the idea that they do is incessantly drilled into our heads at every turn. So this example may be helpful in grasping the principle involved, food poisoning. Some 200,000 Americans are food poisoned every day. 900,000 of them, 900 of them seriously enough to be hospitalized, and 14 out of that 200,000 dies. Food poisoning means that the individual ate some meal items that were already spoiled. Now, since bacteria are scavengers, they're the cleanup crew for any situation involving decomposing, rotting organic matter. As such, rotting food serves as a culture medium in which any number of opportunistic pathogens may set up shop. Let's take Salmonella, for example. An opportunistic bacterium, Salmonella, can proliferate in spoiled meat, dairy, or salad bar items. In the early stages, the food may not appear rotten, and the unsuspecting individual eats it without hesitation. What ensues is 5 to 7 days of intestinal illness involving cramping, fever, nausea, painful bloating. The infection can be readily handled with antibiotics, provided the patient is not resistant because of previous overprescription. But the point that is usually overlooked is this situation, is that the bacteria were not the cause of the disease. The rotting food was the cause. The person who ate the food was ingesting a culture medium with an exploding experiment already ongoing. What is foreign to the body is rotting food, not the bacteria. A single Salmonella, which somehow enters the digestive tract, will only be able to survive if it finds a hospitable environment. If the internal environment is clean, in which normal digestion takes place on a daily basis, no opportunist can get a foothold. In the case of food poisoning, the rotting food is now in a safe environment, which promotes further explosion of the foreign microorganisms. As the infestation grows, soon the body's immune responses are triggered, resulting in the symptoms of illness. Some version of this scenario takes place in the vast majority of disease situations. A toxic environment is already present. Immune resistance is already marginal because of a lifestyle of undernutrition, unhygienic living, exhaustion, bad water, exposure, weakness, or any combination thereof. The body is deficient in necessary vitamins, minerals, and enzymes crucial for normal circulation and resilience. Add to this primed scene a living, breathing, fulminant lab experiment in the form of some infected macaroni, salad, or whatever, and wham, a few hours later, we see one sick patient. But to pretend like Salmonella or other microbe was the cause of such an illness would be disingenuous and inaccurate. Although incorrect, such a conclusion is much easier to understand than what actually took place. But the reason it's promoted as the explanation is that such a setup introduces the necessity for drugs. And we just change gears from science to marketing. See how easy that was? But now you're sophisticated. You're no longer fooled because you know that germs don't cause disease and that they are scavengers, not predators. Questions one must ask when reading about avian flu. There is a simple way to tell whether the stories you're reading about avian flu are likely propaganda or legitimate. Apply this list of questions. Number one, who wrote it? Two, who funded it? Three, is it short on fact, long on interpretation and editorializing? Four, does it cite sources for the statements made in the statistics mentioned? Five, does it make scientific presumption it does not back up? I won't say the numbers, just the questions. Is the only solution to the problem presented a drug or a vaccine? Is there an abundance of emotional trigger words throughout the report? How many times is the word pandemic used? Is there any suggestion that the avian flu threat might just fade out on its own? Is there any mention of how the birds were actually tested? Is there any mention of how the people were actually tested? Is there any suggestion that perhaps germs are not the only cause of disease? Does the article pretend like H5N1 is a proven cause of avian flu? Does the report assume that germs are the only possible cause of disease? That should do it. At least consider the possibility that there is a subtext here and that it's a pattern we have seen before. Invent a disease, hype the extent of the threat, create a drug or vaccine, spend the money, and the threat disappears. How to stand outside the circle of indoctrination. If you read what everyone reads, if you read what everyone reads, you'll think like everyone thinks. On the other hand, if you only read what is verifiable, what is sourced, and what represents the scientifically possible, you will start thinking like a very smart echelon, a very small echelon of the population. This requires the possession of two very rare commodities, the ability for logical discrimination and the capacity for abstract thought. I'm going to say that again. If you read what everyone reads, you'll think like everyone thinks. On the other hand, if you only read what is verifiable, what is sourced, what represents scientifically possible, you will start thinking like a very small echelon of the population. This requires the possession of two... This requires the possession of two very rare commodities, the ability for logic discrimination and the capacity for abstract thought. Qualify yourself. If the following notions seem plausible to you, it's a favorable sign. Germs are not the cause of diseases. They are the sign of diseases. By themselves, they don't cause AIDS. They don't cause polio. They don't cause tetanus, diphtheria, or whooping cough. The true cause of disease is a toxic internal environment, i.e., the blood, which toxicity is itself caused by time-worn conditions of malnutrition, lack of hygiene, bad water, overcrowding, and chronic fatigue, in which people live year after year. Such conditions are the breeding ground for the proliferation of virtually any opportunistic microorganism. But the disease was there first, not the microbe. All press on avian flu is geared to one end, the marketing of drugs, vaccines, and more security. Even Pasteur himself, the formulator of the germ theory, finally admitted that when it came to dis-ease, the terrain was everything and the germ was nothing. Until you finally learn that germs cannot by themselves be the cause of disease, you will continue to be terrorized, not only by the future hysteria surrounding avian flu, but all the new biological threats waiting in the wings in an endless succession, just as they have always done since the time of Edward Jenner. And that's the end of that article. That was perfect timing. I almost never do that. I always run out of time, don't I, folks? I'm glad to be with you, and I'm glad to be able to share this with you. And within the next 2 days, this article will be over to Darren and will be posted in the new section of our website titled Bird Flu. And remember, on Monday next, Tuesday, and Wednesday, I'll be back with you. Darren is working. And then he'll be back with you week after that. And so, folks, have a lovely rest of this week and a lovely weekend. And God bless you, each and every one of you. And we'll see you Monday. Bye-bye.